The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts,
Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. This time, illuminating the dark genome. Sounds like a horror movie sometimes, but we'll get to that in a second. And we have an expert easy today on board. It's Hossein Winzadeh. He's co-founder and CTO of Lucid Genomics in Berlin. And this is exactly where we're sitting, a beautiful office space in Berlin. Good to be back in the capital of Germany. Easy, what's it all about today?
Yeah, today we'll talk about something that I wanted to talk about for a long time, which is the dark genome, which is actually the large proportion of the genome that we don't know that much about, but that might actually have some relevant role for human disease and in general from an evolutionary standpoint. And I think the problem is that for a long time, we didn't have the tools to really decipher this dark part of the genome because we couldn't sequence it. And also we couldn't really make sense of it. And this is where Hossein comes in, because they have a pretty cool AI algorithm that helps us shed some light on all this darkness that we have. And I think this is what we want to talk about today.
Not breaking the rules, we have to start with quotes to get a sense of the lay of the land, of course.
Yes.
What do you bring?
I brought two quotes. One is from George Cassiotis, who's the head of Crick's Retroviral Immunology Lab. And I think he's also involved with a biotech called Inara. And what he says is, while these DNA sequences are parasitic in origin, they are now responsible for at least part of what makes us human. And I think this is part of what I find fascinating about the dark genome, that actually part of it is of viral origin. And that also contributes to its function. The other quote that I brought is actually from a colleague of Hossein, who in an interview said, our algorithms analyze the entire genome to detect genetic variation that are overlooked by conventional approaches. This is from Jakob Herzberg. He's the head of technology at Lucid. And I think this is exactly what we want to dive into today. And I have to say, in the preparation for this episode, I sometimes have these moments where I think I know something about a topic. And the deeper I dig, the more I realize, oof, I should know more about that because I studied biology and I work in biotech and pharma for a very long time. But somehow there is a lot that we don't know. And I think this is the exciting thing that we talk about, especially with a biorevolution venturing into new spaces.
Yeah, and Hossein, I think we have a wonderful expert who comes from the side of numbers, if we want to call it like that, from the computational side, from the data side of things. But we, of course, have to start with the question. In the year 2003, we had the feeling we have it. We know it all. The Genome Project, not so much, right?
Yes. So, pleasure to be here. Yes, we sequenced the first human genome. It was amazing to know at least like this 2 meter long DNA that each cell is carrying. How does it look like? But it was just the beginning. Yes, it was billions dollar project, and now we want to know more about each individual.
Of course, pharma wants to know how many billions we have to add to decipher the remaining 98%.
Yes, exactly. So let me start at least with dark genome or
yes.
Junk DNA or non-coding. And I like the non-coding better than the other now, because we can explain it there from there on in a better way. So let's talk about coding DNA first. So going back to central dogma biology, we have genes and which are transcribed to RNA, and then protein, and proteins do the function. And these are the coding DNA. Actually, in human genome, we have 20,000 of genes. There are regions which are connecting these genes. Of course, like the genome, this 2 meter long thread, is compacted in chromosomes and the 20,000 genes. And then these are this non-coding DNA, which do not code any protein, are connecting these part of the DNA. Then we got to know about these 20,000, and we wanted to know what are the rest? What do they do? From the other side, we knew that in all cells in the human body, we have the same DNA. But some genes are on in one cell or one tissue, some genes are off in the other tissue. And why is that? This is where the non-coding DNA comes to play. I really like the analogy that my co-founder and CEO of a company used. The genes are lamps and the non-coding DNA are the wiring and switches. Sometimes we find a lamp which should be on, off in a patient, and that's not because of the lamp is having a problem, because the wiring has a problem, and this is where the non-coding DNA comes to play.
That's an excellent analogy, I have to say. This is really nice, yeah.
This is very easy to pass it on.
Absolutely,
I really like it.
I like it.
So we have to get to the approaches to decipher what is actually going on. And maybe we start with covering what is the lay of the land as we speak in 2025. Where do we stand right now? Maybe easier to start.
I think the foundation for any possibility to analyze the dark genome, obviously, is to know or to sequence the dark genome. And I think there we actually start with that we had for a long time challenges with actually knowing what's even in the dark genome before we can make sense of it, because the sequencing technology did not lend itself well to the dark or the non-coding genome as well as it did to the coding parts of the genome, where basically we used a we could call it a trick maybe, where you sequence small parts, short reads, and then you assemble it basically back together computationally. But the dark part or the non-coding parts of the genome, they have repetitive elements. They are just very different from their composition. Also, Kostin, please correct me if I'm wrong, probably because they have less evolutionary pressure than do the coding parts of the genome, where evolution is more concerned with getting it right. So here, I think the first part is actually in terms of getting a better understanding of this dark genome, that we have different sequencing technologies now, right, that even allow us to do that.
Exactly. Like, I think we have to talk about it from two angles. One is the technology and the other is the nature of the DNA. As you mentioned, many repetitive regions are in the human genome. About half of our genome are repeats. What does that mean? That means that there are sequences which are very similar, maybe identical for some, maybe similar with a couple of mutations. But then when you sequence a read from a genome, you need to know from where you sample it. And then these repeats, actually the available technologies will sample them. But since the available technologies are short, we don't know from where we sample it. There is no signal for me to understand as a computational biologist, is the sequence from chromosome 1 or 5? This is tough. Yes, this is tough. Where the technology is able to give us enough signal to figure out from where we sequence those reads. And when it came to long reads, where we were able to read a longer stretch of a DNA, we have higher chance to find conserved region or unique region that I say, I know now, this read is from chromosome 1 and not chromosome 5, for example. And there we can have the whole DNA in the first place, and then we can analyze it to see what is the role of elements in the whole DNA.
Are there already like practical success stories when it comes to long read sequencing, where you could say at that point we really determined where it's from and what it does?
We are dealing with a very complex scenario. Yes.
Hossein is not shying away, ladies and gentlemen. This is the state of things, right, that you refer to.
Yes, yes. It's like as we dig more, we learn that we know less and we need more data to understand. So, of course, the longer, the better, the higher the accuracy, the better, because then you can find small signal to say this read is from that region. For example, some of the repetitive elements are shorter, like there are a couple of hundred. So if a technology is larger than this a couple of hundred, let's say 500, then we can find a region next to the repetitive elements and say this read comes from that region, and then we can understand what's the role of that repetitive element in that region. When we go, for example, to centromere or telomeres, these are larger regions with repeats, then we need very long reads. For example, for the effort T2T, telomere to telomere sequencing, scientists were able to do that with, for example, nanopore technology, where we have a couple of reads which are megabytes long, and with the mutations in these kind of regions, we were able to, for the first time, claiming that we are able to know at least one individual or one cell type end-to-end. Why I said cell type? Because human is also diploid, and we have two of these copies, and then this makes it harder to assemble.
So basically, with the telomere-to-telomere project, where we were with the Human Genome Project 20-some years ago. So we have now this one version of having, so telomere, I think we talked about it when we talked, for example, about cell rejuvenation, are the ends of the chromosomes that act potentially as protective caps, but that fray out a little bit as the cell ages. Mm-hmm. But here, really, this would mean we don't only have this 2% or a little bit more of the genome sequence, but we really have telomere to telomere, we have it all, which I would say may be similar to what we had with the decoding of the human genome. I'm making air quotes now, which you cannot see, but I think this is the, I mean, as you say, there is a lot of context dependency, right? I mean, it's not having one genome is helpful, but what's really helpful is having a lot of genomes from a lot of people to get a better understanding of what the variation might be in cell types, in people, across disease, across developmental stages. So one question, why would we actually care so much? I mean, this is now I'm taking the role of asking maybe a little bit stupid question, but why would we care so much on which chromosome our non-coding DNA is located if it doesn't code for anything? Why do we want to know?
So that's a good question, actually. I don't know if how much is important. So it is important to know from where the sequence is located. Because when we talk about non-coding DNA, we are talking about functional elements. And there are different functional elements in non-coding DNA. So some of them are enhancers, promoters, some of them are enhancing gene regulation, they call enhancers, or silencers, those which are blocking gene regulations. If you don't know where they are located, you cannot also know on which gene they're regulating it in a different way.
Yeah. This is something that I drew on a piece of paper yesterday because I made a little explanation of what we're going to talk about. So I drew this nice stretch of DNA and then I placed the promoter, which is the activating element of a gene, and then I placed the enhancers, which act on the gene to increase its expression, and the silencers, and then I also showed that it has a nice 3D structure, that it's not all, because I think textbook-wise, we always imagine the DNA either as like a linear stretch or in this X shape of the chromosome, but of course in reality this is like a wool little like messy coil of things, and whatever gets close to one another spatially will also interact with one another with the proteins that activate or repress.
Exactly. I think this is very important to mention. Like DNA is a kind of, the whole DNA is chopped to chromosomes, mm-hmm. but it's not the end. It's like we have inside the chromosome many, many 3D folded piece of like, or bubble of threads. And in this bubble, different functional elements are talking to each other. And this is very important to kind of take into account. Yeah. So the other functional element in non-coding DNA are these elements which are making these structures. And we now with assays are able to read these structures. Like with Hi-C, we know like which part of DNA is close to what part. And also we can see what is talking to what. And we can go from 1D DNA towards a 3D DNA and talking about gene expression in a totally another level. And without knowing these elements, we cannot understanding again the final product, which are the protein and gene expression.
So basically, if we go back to our wool analogy, if you either you have it cut into small pieces and you need to somehow know where these pieces belonged, or you have like some idea of what actually the 3D structure of your, what's the name for like a wool ball, ball of wool, whatever. Mm. Knäuel is the
German word.
The German word. I have no idea. But just having this 3D alignment, getting some idea of what actually interacts with what. So now maybe you can talk a little bit about, because I think this is also where, again, we get to this exciting part. I mean, it's already pretty exciting because I think this idea of having this whole unknown space of DNA, and I mean, 98%, that's a lot, right? And maybe not all of it is functional, but there is definitely things across this long stretch that are functional. So what are the difficulties with assigning this function? I mean, we already talked about, like, you need to know where it belongs, you need to know what kind of element it is, but maybe you can talk a little bit about why are we having such a hard time assigning the function.
And I would also like to add, if there are any like estimates, if we talk about this dark genome and we have those 98%, which is impressive, how much of it might or might not be functional at the end of the day? I mean, this is at the current stage probably a little bit wild guessing, but maybe it's somewhat close to the future reality.
Mm-hmm. So it's a debate on it. And also it really depends on how, from which functionality you are looking at the DNA and non-coding DNA. So about 10%, if you go, or even less, when you go to the regions which are conserved in non-coding DNA. And if you talk about having some functionality, it can go to 80% of DNA being functional. And it really depends on how you look at it. So when we talk about these different elements and what they do and what are their roles, then we have to kind of either focus on one part, specifically in science, is like, okay, now I just want to look at human genome or primate genomes and see what are the conserved region. And from there, I can understand what, or I can infer they should have a role in gene regulation. And then that would be about, I don't know, 10%. And then when we go, okay, now I want to find enhancers. I want to have those elements which are shaping the DNA in these coils, then we can go to 80%.
And I think, again, one part of that might also be that it's context dependent, right? I mean, we have different cell types, we have different developmental stages, so probably not everything will show its function at all times, but the function might show up only in a very specific cell type, only if it's, for example, experiencing some stress or any other factors that come into play, which I think also makes it very hard for this bulk analysis of taking a scrambled amount of cells and saying, what's the function? We would have, of course, to dive on a single cell level and again, check what happens there.
So we are dealing with a very complex system. We have linear DNA, which we are now getting to understand what's the sequence of these DNA with new technologies. Of course, with new technologies, because not super scalable and we don't have that much data. We know it, for example, in telomere to telomere for one cell, but we don't know the variety of these variations in the genome, and I will come back to the human variations afterward. Then on top of these DNA level, we have epigenetic marks, we have 3D genome structure, we don't know what is talking to what in this 3D genome, in each cell, in each cell line, in each tissue, and this makes it very hard to understand it, as simple as that. And we need a lot more data to figure out what's happening in each tissue, in each cell line. And we know that biology is super complex. And maybe this is where the AI comes to the game. AI helps us from two parts. One is it finds patterns very well on big data. Of course, in biology, we want to know mechanisms, but AI helps us to shed light on patterns. And from the other side, we are able to denoise data with AI. So in this game, in dark DNA game, AI can help us from two parts. First, detecting the mutations in a higher accuracy. And when I talk to mutations, we talk about variations. We have small variations, we have larger variations, structural variants, we have tandem repeats. And that's one part that AI can help us. And from the other part is like, now I know the variations, how I can make sense of these variations in different tissues, individuals, populations. This is where AI can help us a lot with pattern finding.
So maybe one thing, again, going back to this very simple question, why would we then care about that? So, I mean, you spend probably a lot of time of your life already developing the algorithm. What do you think will be the benefit of having this tool to decipher the dark genome?
Let me start from rare diseases, and we can talk about cancer and common diseases afterwards as well. So currently, the diagnostic rate for rare diseases is about 40%. Why is that? So, and we know like about 80% of patients with rare diseases, they have genetic background. And we already found many cases that the elements in dark DNA is causing these diseases. So there is a gap now between 40% to 100%, and we have to understand why is that, and the dark DNA can be where we have to go because we also have data right now. And these mechanisms are very simple and understandable. For example, in diagnostic, we have compound heterozygosity. What does that mean? This means that we have two copies of each gene and we have mutations which are hitting these genes. If both genes are off, then we see the disease. If one of them is off, then we don't see that. On the coding region, we can find two mutations in different locations. One is hitting one and the other is hitting the other allele, and then we see the disease. What if I see one mutation in the gene and one mutation in the enhancer of the gene in the other allele, and that shut down both of the genes, and then you see the disease? So this is a missing part. From the other side, if there are mutations on enhancers, simply you see the gene and it's intact, but the enhancer is off and causing the disease, or you see mutations in the boundary of these coils, and then you see one enhancer comes from another region and talk to the gene in that and then make it off or on.
Is that what's called enhancer hijacking? Or
yes.
I like the term, but I didn't fully understand it.
The scenario I talk is about two neighboring regions, mm-hmm. but it can be also like an element which is injected from another region and come to a region, and then in that specific tissue it makes that gene on or off.
So you would say there is a lot of unexplored, and I work a lot in the rare disease space, so right. I know that this is like, on the one hand, I mean, many people don't get a diagnosis. On the other hand, often they have to wait very, very long till they get the correct diagnosis. So it could just be that a lot of the genetic information is simply missing because we're focusing only on the coding regions and we're missing these relevant parts that could be explored. Yeah.
So how confident are you that, I'm not asking about a time frame or so, that eventually we get there, that the deciphering of the dark genome is getting to a point where we jump from, when it comes to rare diseases, from 40 to, say, 80%. And let's also include the diseases that we're facing in our civilization, like cancer or Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. and include that as well.
So I did my postdoc at Max Planck Institute with close collaboration with Charité Hospital. And we had quite some cases that we were able to diagnose them by hits on non-coding DNA causing disease. So these are the samples that we collected, and it was not possible to diagnose them with regular technologies and also looking at the coding genes. Now, for a subset, we are able to answer it, to diagnose some, but then now we have to jump to the 60% undiagnosed cases and see like how many of those can be answered with this technology and looking at the dark DNA.
And I imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, it's simply also a question of the amount of information, right? Because if we say we focus on the coding region, which is then 2%, then if we have for the rest, I mean, it's just massively more sequencing information that we have to go through to pinpoint the relevant regions, right? If we, I mean, it's just by basically a factor 100, almost factor 50, sorry, by a factor 50 more information that we have to sift through to get to an answer than we would if we only focus on the coding region.
Of course. Yeah. Yes.
Is AI good enough to do that faster? Because if I now, I mean, for my normal applications use a large language model, to be honest, it doesn't matter anymore. If I would have taken 50 years to read it, it still reads it in like 3 minutes now or three mm-hmm. seconds.
So of course AI helps a lot. But to me, it's like I have scientist mindset because there we are looking for mechanisms, and also AI mindset, of course, like science and AI is like, it's the same thing, but it's not like I put a bunch of data in a black box and get some answer for that. We, as a scientist, we need to understand why. And there are patterns which are not visible with human eye that we can see it with AI, and then we can answer the question in a faster, much faster way.
One other part that I would find fascinating, so we focus now on the diagnosis, which I guess for rare diseases is very strong case. I can imagine also for other more common diseases, there could be some genetic basis that could be interesting. But how do you see the potential of exploring parts of the dark genome actually as drug targets or using them for drug discovery on top of using it as a diagnostic tool? Would you say there is a lot of unexplored potential there of targeting elements? For example, there, I think there are some biotechs, for example, Haya, that are trying to target the long non-coding RNAs mm-hmm. or also this endogenous retroviral elements. Mm-hmm. How would you see the potential of that?
That's a very hard question. And if you can answer
it. Every question is hard today.
Yes. You know? Because we are going to unknowns. And also, like, the data is just coming. Also, very noisy data is just coming. This makes it hard. And this is the question that probably every investor is asking themselves, like, shall I invest on that or not?
Because will there be a pill? Yes, of course.
Exactly. Sure. For that, we need, of course, to read out the dark DNA first, or better to call it non-coding DNA. And still, technologies are going to get there. And also, the science is going to get there. So what is the potential? We believe that the potential is super high. That's why we are tackling this big challenge. How to tackle it? Of course, there are different ways. And we started with detection of elements in dark DNA because, as you mentioned, many repeats are in there. And from the other side, the sequencing technologies, which are dominant, are still short read. Maybe I can elaborate a little bit on that. So 2018, we have started a project for comparing different technologies. We wanted to know where we are heading in future, maybe in 5 years or more, where we are now. We started with sequencing patients with long-read DNA and long-read sequencing, and also other technologies. At the time, 10x had a technology called linked-read sequencing. And then we were thinking, of course, these will be the future because DNA is full of repeats and we cannot just go with short read. Then after working on the project for 1 year, we figured out short read is dominant. We looked at 1 million genome projects, for example, European 1 million genome project, and most of these samples were supposed to be sequenced with short read. And then we thought, okay, if you're betting on long read, then what are these, most of 97%, what does that mean? We changed the gear at the time and we said, why not creating a good database and train our model, and this is where AI comes to help, on good database, but applying that for short read. And to understand what are the elements first in non-coding DNA, and even on repetitive regions in coding. This is one way that one can tackle to understand, okay, now we have telomere to telomere, but for every individual which is sequenced with short read, is it possible to understand what is the composition of mutations over there? What are these different type of mutations? As I mentioned, small structure or even tandem repeats. So from the other side, we know, for example, functionality of some of these elements like enhancers or like long non-coding DNA, that RNA that they're binding to the DNA, and we know how they're suppressed, for example, gene expression. that's the other way to tackle understanding non-coding. And of course, like, there are players in this space which are specifically doing that, for example, for cancer. So I would say there are different ways to tackle. For example, the other thing that we focused on was interpreting non-coding DNA, of course, with AI and also with normal algorithms, like implementation of known mechanisms into the game. This is the way that we decided to tackle this problem. Why AI? Because, again, it's about denoising and pattern recognition, knowing the structure variants, being causative. Is it possible with AI find patterns that we can go now look at other part of the genome and find causative or potentially causative mutations? Or, again, denoising with AI, the super noisy data that we have. From the other side is, can we bring the known mechanisms, for example, this enhancer hijacking, to the game and analysis? Because when you look at the way that people are tackling this problem, it's like either they focus on detection and technology or interpretation or visualization or even creating hypothesis. So creating hypothesis on what's happening really in each cell or in a cell of interest. And we thought these are not four problems. This is one problem that has to be seen in one picture. I need to know my variations. I need to know what are the roles. I need to align it with, of course, gene expression, epigenetic marks, and drive some hypothesis. And then having expert looking at the hypothesis and say, yes, this is the cause. Because, again, we are not talking about proteins which we know the function. We are talking about changes which the genes are intact again.
So I would, if I listen to you, see your technology also as an enabler for many of the other roads that you can go down, right? Because it gives you a good capture, gives you an interpretation, and gives you a certain mechanistic understanding of what's actually happening, which, coming from a science background, is of course the best way to tackle any problem in biology, to get a mechanistic understanding before you go down any other road. So I think this sounds actually quite exciting.
Yes, it's also enabler when you know the DNA composition. It's enabler in terms of looking at population data and find biomarkers which had not been seen before by aligning population data and focusing on the regions which you have. You get some signal and find biomarkers that one can use for drug targets or identifications.
So, guys, let's switch to the philosophy department, closing in just a little bit, because I would really be interested to know something about, maybe in a few sentences, about, does it all need to make sense? Does the dark genome, or you picked the other expression for good reason, I think.
Non-coding.
The non-coding. Does it need to make sense doing your research? What do you think?
So, dark DNA, non-coding, these are words.
You know? Right, right.
And you're talking about biology.
And we want completely different, of course.
Yeah, it's like, and this is all about understanding the biology. And we know how important is every element in our cells. And of course, like, if we go, for example, back 20 years ago, maybe, or I don't know, 40, the game was different. And there were unknowns at the time, and which are super known now. And it's like, okay, we know about these and we don't know about... I think it's important to understand DNA. It's important to understand the role of each element in the DNA and how they are talking to each other. We need to know epigenetic marks in the DNA. We need to know how they are transcribed, how now the product of transcription, either becoming a protein later or even long non-coding RNAs, are talking to each other in order to go towards maybe the final aim, which is personalized medicine. We are different, the same as we are very similar. And that's why, like, for example, you use one drug for some patients and fails for the others. Why is that? If we want to answer it, we have to tackle it. And and the only way to tackle that is understanding the differences.
Right. We see that even now in cancer medication that's so differentiated compared to 20 years ago, even now. And if we add up your expertise and knowledge. And by the way, listeners, if you hear some background noise, this is a busy company here and people need to talk. So please forgive us. We were in the middle of a fascinating business recording this easy. Your take also about the functionality question coming from biology.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. When I started studying the microRNAs were just coming up, I was super fascinated. One got the Nobel Prize just very recently. So I think, I mean, these were complete novelties, right? These are new molecules that have a regulatory role that were considered junk DNA before. So now we didn't know what it was doing. Then came the long non-coding RNAs. Who knows what else is in the genome that we just haven't captured yet, because I think it would be hubris to say just because we have sequenced it, we know it all. I think there will be more surprises in my expectation, because I think that's what we've learned from biology, that new things arise that we hadn't accounted for and that will probably play a role. And I think one part, what you mentioned, I mean, we have also different layers of regulation. We have epigenetic, we have post-transcriptional, post-translational. And I think part of this is really in the combinatorial logic of all these elements playing in together, which our brains, I think, cannot compute anymore, but which AI will help us to decipher in the long run, hopefully. And then I would also say that evolution doesn't have to make sense. It's not like the best of all possible worlds, but evolution has its mechanisms that will bring up some stuff that makes sense, but some stuff maybe also doesn't really make sense. So I think we're in for some surprises when it comes to understanding the non-coding region of our genome. And I want to apologize for saying dark genome throughout, but I just find it such a sexy term that
it
I
is.
Could
it
not
is.
Resist.
I would love to stick to it as well. So, the BioRevolution podcast, Illuminating the Dark Genome, I stick to the expression right now, too, new insights into the genetic basis of disease. Thank you very much, Hossein, for your expertise and for sharing this with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah.
Thank you, Izzy, as always.
Thank you. Fantastic. I think that was really very interesting stuff.
It is. In fact, it's breathtaking. And I guess everybody who wants to read into it a little bit deeper will get a lot of links, as always,
at... in the show notes. At sciencetales.com.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.